welcome to A Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, June 2nd, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll talk with the National Ambassador of Youth Literature, Kate DiCamillo, about her visit to the Juno Libraries this week. Susie Martin, June's featured artist at the Canvas, will be here to highlight her first Friday show. We'll talk about the upcoming Trauma and Suicide Prevention Conference with Hillary Young and Julie Neihart, and we'll find out about this year's Only Fools Run at Midnight event with guests Justin Showman and Tristan Newsom Lombardo, and we'll get the details about this year's Juno Symphony Youth Solo Competition right here on the Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. This week on our program, we're taking a look at rural sanitation in Alaska. Modern sanitation is considered one of, if not the most important, public health achievements of the 20th century. It's helped cut U.S. mortality rates by 40% and has contributed to raising life expectancy from 47 to 63 years of age. So why is modern plumbing not a part of life for all Alaskans? Today we'll hear about some of the reasons. KMBA's Jocelyn Estes reports.
Building piped water and sewer systems in Alaska isn't easy, and it isn't cheap. It costs from $3 to $10 million and up to build a water treatment plant, water tanks, and sewage lagoon, and to install pipes and plumbing in every house. That's a lot of money. But Alaska's vast distances, high transportation costs, and the cost of making everything sturdy enough to withstand Arctic and subarctic winters add up quickly. Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation remote maintenance worker Bob White says facilities are built to reduce construction costs and to hold up under Alaskan conditions. In Kwikluk, for instance, to avoid putting in large underground pipes, each home is getting a grinder pump that will move sewage through narrow 2-inch pipes.
They're expensive, and they're heavy. This one's brand new. This has actually all been redesigned because their original design broke. Part of the problem, it wouldn't take the harsh conditions. Pump manufacturer actually started making an Arctic version. And so this is their Arctic version.
The Kwikluk treatment plant also has sophisticated features to reduce the cost of maintenance and operations. It has computerized controls, for instance, and sensors that will send out alerts if something isn't working as it should. A 1994 report by the Federal Office of Technology Assessment recommended an annual budget of $120 million for rural sanitation in Alaska. Federal and state funding combined never reached that level, and now officials say it will take $900 million to catch up. That's on top of $2.2 billion already spent over the past two decades. In a recent presentation, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium Sanitation Facilities Program Manager David Beveridge told legislators most of that money has come from federal agencies.
If you look through the Build Safe Water Program, it gets matched with federal dollars on a 75% ratio. So for every $25, the federal government will kick in the $75. So that's been a big component of the funding in Alaska, and that's gone down.
In 2014, the state legislature allocated $7.5 million for village safe water. That's out of a $13 billion state budget, and it was allocated to match $50 million from the Indian Health Service, Environmental Protection Agency, and U.S. Department of Agriculture, but federal funding has dropped by 64% in the last 10 years. The gap between what's needed and what's available is getting wider, and the lack of money for maintenance and operations is damaging existing systems. We'll find out more about that next time. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
For this series, news director Jocelyn Estes traveled to communities in northwest Alaska in 2014 and then to villages in southwest Alaska earlier this year. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Support by the Association of American Indian Physicians. Colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in American Indians 50 and over. For yourself, your family, and our community, get screened. Info at AmericanIndianCancer.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And you're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, June 2nd, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. And with me now in the studio is artist Susie Martin. Susie, welcome to the show. Nice to have you. And also from the canvas, Phoebe Rohrbacher. She's an art studio assistant there. Welcome to the show, Phoebe.
Thank you.
Nice to have you. And also Megan Crowley, another assistant arts studio person from the canvas. Welcome, Megan.
Hi.
So welcome all three of you, and we're here to talk about Susie Martin is going to be having a solo show as part of First Friday at the Canvas this Friday. Hey, Susie, would you like to tell us a little bit about the kind of art that you make?
Can you say hello?
You feeling nervous a little bit?
Susie, a little nervous.
Jesus birthday.
Okay.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, Susie's excited for a pizza party that's happening tomorrow.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, she's got a couple of pieces of art or photos of her artwork. Susie, who's in this picture? Who made that?
Thank you.
You want to tell the people on the radio?
Susie's holding up a very cool sort of figurative piece of ceramic art with a face on it. I like it. So can you guys tell me a little bit about what the show is going to look like on Friday?
Just a birthday, 2 weeks. The hot pizza.
Yeah. Well, Susie's artwork recently has been very figurative, and it focuses a lot on repetition of figures. She works primarily in charcoal, graphite, watercolor, and ceramics. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
There's a lot of people in the images. Susie often will work from an image of one person, but she might end up drawing 10 people. Mm-hmm. And all of the faces are really different and really expressive.
They are. They're very striking. Something about the repetition and perspective in your images, Susie, I really like that. And so it'll be a mixture of prints on the wall and ceramic sort of sculpture stuff. What else can we expect?
Well, there will be some snacks there.
Yay! Yeah. Susie will be there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you can meet Susie.
Yeah, and there'll be a combination of large-scale work and also some stuff that's smaller and more intimate. And the ceramic pieces are also portraits, and so they're just real small faces made out of porcelain that Susie's painted with underglazes. And those will be displayed on the wall as well.
Okay, mm-hmm. Excellent. Susie, what kind of subjects do you like to draw or do you like to sculpt? Where do you find pictures? Where do you find your subjects?
Who's that? Can you tell them on the radio who's in that picture?
I'm going to hear you.
Yeah, the radio.
Yeah.
Who is that?
Who's in the drawings that you did? Can you tell Scott? Well, I'll just answer a little bit, if that's okay, Susie. So Susie she's worked from pictures of herself and done some self-portraits, so there will be a self-portrait in the show. Recently she's been working from historic pictures of Tlingit people that will be... and so she's done her own expressions of those as well.
All right. Susie, what do you like most about drawing or making sculpture? What does art do for you?
you tell us about your art on the radio? Do you have anything you want to say? Been a little radio shy, maybe.
Yeah. Well, maybe can you tell me a little bit about what you see in the studio and how art is handled there and what it does for all the folks participating there?
Sure. Well, with Susie specifically, we'll get Susie set up with materials and a reference image at the beginning of class. And her process is to look at that reference material and then kind of take that as a jumping off point. And it'll turn into something completely different. But it's interesting because she uses a layering process. So she'll start with a certain material, and then that first layer might get completely covered up by the end. So it's interesting because all of the images that she's working from have some sort of a relation to her life. And so it's cool because then she kind of forms this relationship with the images by using this repetitive process. So it's a really interesting process. And when Susie's working, she's got this big smile on her face, and you can tell she's really enjoying it.
Yeah.
That's something that means a lot to her.
But she's also, you're kind of secretive about your work.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times we'll ask questions at the canvas, and Susie, you'll not tell us anything. So
yeah.
In some ways it's a bit of a mystery.
Until this Friday when we get to see all of her work.
Mm-hmm.
Looking forward to it. Can you all tell us about the details about Friday's event?
Yeah. First Friday will start at 4:30, and people are invited to come down to the canvas at 223 Seward Street. The opening reception is June 5th, 4:30 to 7 p.m. And we hope that you'll be able to come look at Susie's work, because, of course, it's a lot easier to see it than it is to hear about it.
Sure, and you sort of brought these giclées or prints with you today. How are some of these pieces presented at the gallery?
They're going to be framed with a simple white mat, and then a really nice alder frames that Brandon Howard has been working on.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty simple framing, trying to really highlight the drawings and paintings themselves.
Okay, well, it sounds like a lot of fun. And then, do you guys usually keep a show up for about a month at the canvas?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so for the month of, let's see, I guess it's June, we'll have a chance to see Susie Martin's work at the canvas. And, yeah, go ahead.
I just want to mention all the pieces will also be for sale. And
mm-hmm.
so if you're looking to get some amazing art in your life, this might be a great opportunity to come on down.
Absolutely. And for more information, where should somebody go?
They can go to canvasarts.org.
Okay. Well, thank you three so much, Phoebe Rohrbacher, Susie Martin, Megan Crowley, for coming in today. Are we missing anything? Anything you want to add?
Do you want to add anything, Susie?
All right. Well, I will see you all on Friday.
All right. Thanks.
See you later.
Oh, I wait for summer when this time the waves dry. No time, honey, there's no time.
You're listening to a Juno afternoon here on Tuesday, June 2nd, 2015. Currently 63 degrees at the Juno Airport, and it's about 18 minutes past the top of the hour.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 2nd of June, 2015. 1865, on this day, the Civil War came to a formal end. Confederate General Kirby Smith surrendered his forces west of the Mississippi, and the Confederate Army ceased to exist, and the war that cost 620,000 American lives was over. It's the birthday of Thomas Hardy, born in Dorset, England, 1840. He was an architect who set out to write novels, and with the publication of his fourth novel, Far From the Madding Crowd, 1874, he turned to writing full-time. His novel set in the area he called Wessex, the southwestern counties of England, The Return of the Native, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, Jude the Obscure. There was some controversy about Jude the Obscure, about his depiction of sex, and he turned away from fiction and turned to poetry. Published his first collection when he was 58 years old, went on to publish seven more, about 1,000 poems in his lifetime. It's the birthday of Barbara Pym, born Shropshire, England, 1913, author of comic novels about upper-middle-class life in England, including Excellent Women and Quartet in Autumn. It's the birthday of the novelist Carol Shields, born Oak Park, Illinois, 1935. She married after college, moved to Winnipeg, had five children, and being a mother inspired her to write. She said, "Having children woke me up. I knew I had to pay attention. All my senses seemed sharpened. I seemed capable of more." Her first novel, Small Ceremonies. Her big success was Stone Diaries in 1993. The story of a woman named Daisy Goodwill Flett lives to be 90, goes from Manitoba to Sarasota, Florida, is married several times, raises children, and whose final thought at the end of her life is, "I am not at peace." And it's the birthday of Dorothy West, born in Boston, 1907, moved to Harlem, became part of the Harlem Renaissance, a friend of Ralph Ellison and Richard Wright. Finally settled on Martha's Vineyard, her family's childhood vacation home, where she wrote two novels, The Living is Easy and The Wedding, in 1995, set on Martha's Vineyard in the 1950s. Story of a wealthy black family's struggle with identity and race as the youngest daughter prepares to marry a white jazz musician. Here's a poem for today by Annie Lightheart, entitled The Hundred Names of Love. The children have gone to bed. We are so tired we could fold ourselves neatly behind our eyes and sleep mid-word, sleep standing, warm among the creatures in the barn, lean together and sleep, forgetting each other completely in the velvet, the forgiveness of that sleep. Then the one small cry, the strike of the matchhead of sound, one child's voice and the hundred names of love are lit as we rise and walk down the hall. 100 nights we wake like this, wake out of our nowhere to kneel by small beds in darkness. 100 flowers open in our hands, a name for love written in each one. A poem by Annie Lightheart, The Hundred Names of Love, from Iron String, published by Airlie Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Help finish the fight against cancer and join the American Cancer Society Relay for Life of Juneau event. Juneau's Relay for Life event takes place in June and involves a fun-filled 18-hour walk. Money raised helps individuals in every community receive free information and service while funding groundbreaking cancer research to save more lives. More information at RelayForLifeOfJuneau.org.
You're listening to A Juneau Afternoon here on Tuesday, June 2nd, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. It's about 23 minutes after the top of the hour, and I am in the studio now with two members of the Juneau Suicide Prevention Coalition, Hillary Young and Julie Neihart. Welcome, Julie and Hillary, to the show.
Thank you, Scott, thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here on the show. So you have a conference coming up here soon on June 18th and 19th at Centennial Hall. I want to talk about that in a minute. Could we start, though, by an introduction to the Juneau Suicide Prevention Coalition? When did it come to be and how?
Well, it's been in existence about 8 years, and it started because there were quite a few suicides in the community, and the people on the community knew that we didn't want to be losing lives, and if there was something to do to prevent that, that would be wonderful. So they got together and formed a coalition. And the membership of the coalition has varied a little bit from time to time in terms of individuals, but there have been groups of people that have been consistent, agencies or organizations that have stuck with it. And Hillary can probably fill you in now with a little bit about which organizations we have.
Please do.
Yeah, so we have all different types of representation from community sectors. We have people from law enforcement. We have religious leaders. We have people from the behavior health fair, like social services field. We have people from SEARCH on there, people from the Violence Prevention Coalition and AWARE. We have individuals who have lost someone to suicide or been touched by a suicide. We have public health representation. Okay. That's pretty good. There's probably some others, but
did you mention law enforcement?
Yeah, I said law enforcement.
Okay. Rotary?
No, Rotary too.
Rotary clubs and Coast Guard. And I personally happen to represent NAMI Juneau on the coalition.
Okay, sounds pretty comprehensive support.
Yeah.
And so you're going to have a conference on the 18th and 19th. Tell us a little bit about that conference and what's going to be going on there.
So over the past year, the coalition has been working on a community needs assessment to figure out what are some things that are contributing to suicide specifically. And trauma was one of the things that we had figured out through some data. And so our conference theme is Trauma and Suicide, Breaking the Link. So it will be at Centennial Hall on June 18th and 19th from 8:30 to 4:30 p.m. We're going to have food catered by Abby's Kitchen. It's going to be all free, and we also are seeking CEUs for those that might need credit. So
CEUs?
Continuing education units. Yes, thank you. for counselors or teachers or administrators, those who might need professional development credit.
Yeah, speaking of those kinds of folks, who would benefit from attending the conference, would you say?
Well, we have listed as a target audience. Well, first let me say the last thing. Members of the general public are invited to participate. But in addition to that, all behavioral health and primary health care providers, law enforcement officers and staff, educators, child care providers, social service workers, early childhood development experts, civic leaders, tribal leaders, faith community, business people are the targeted audience of this conference.
So we're basically gearing it towards any professionals in the community, because I think anyone would benefit, any professional or community member would benefit from attending.
Okay, and what can those folks expect? Is it a Thursday and a Friday, 18th and 19th? What days are those?
Yes,
that's correct.
Yeah, and what can they expect at the actual conference?
So we are going to have four different main workshops. We're going to have Patrick Sidmore from the Mental Health Board and Shirley Pitts, who works with early childhood for the state of Alaska, and they're going to talk about adverse childhood experiences and developing resiliency and the link between that and suicide. And then we are going to have Amalia Monreal and Lenora Walker from Tlingit and Haida, and they're going to talk about intergenerational trauma within the Alaska Native population, and then some cultural solutions to that. And then we are going to have Elaine DeMello. She's coming from New Hampshire. She works for NAMI New Hampshire, and she's a suicide prevention expert. And then our final speaker is Liz Weaver from the Tamarack Institute in Canada, which is an institute for community engagement, and she's doing a workshop titled Collective Impact, and that's really about an approach for communities to work together and to collaborate to solve a complex problem.
Okay, and you said that this is free. Is that right, Julie?
That's correct. This is free. The food will be furnished, not only lunch, but also foods at break. And
a continental breakfast.
Continental breakfast, thank you.
But to get the food, they have to register by June 10th, because we have to have our list into the caterers by the 11th. So.
And where does one go to register?
They can go to JunoSuicidePrevention.org, and then if they click on the home tab on the left of the page, there'll be information on the conference.
Okay. Hillary Young and Julie Neihardt, thank you both for coming in today. What else would you like to add? What are we missing?
Well, we didn't talk yet about the evening session.
Oh, yeah. Please do.
So we have an evening session, which will be on Thursday evening from 5:30 to 7 p.m. And at this session, the Suicide Prevention Coalition will present the results of this community needs assessment and give an opportunity for discussion. So we think it's important for people to come and hear, and particularly folks who are interested in this but really can't get away during the day. So this is another opportunity to get some information, not the same information, but interesting information, we hope.
Tell us a little bit about what kind of information that will present. I think it sounds a little obvious, but just to make sure.
Well, we The coalition is funded by a grant from the Division of Behavioral Health, and this past year that funding went to do this major assessment that we've done of the community. So it involved checking out a lot of data and looking at it in different ways and comparing a variety of different, criteria, and seeing what things work together. We found that items in combination are things that cause people to think about killing themselves. So someone may have had some negative experiences, but that isn't a problem unless there's a combination of them. And so the assessment found those kinds of combinations. Also talks about the various things that can make someone resilient, so that regardless of what's been happening, you're still going to be fine. And so resiliency is a really important thing. And Hillary has a list of things that are important, I think, to keep people going strong, even if they're in the midst of adversity.
Yeah, so I think what resiliency, or what we call protective factors, are, you know, if people have some sort of connection or sense of belonging, some like positive friendships or relationships in their life, if they are involved in some sort of productive or like healthy activity, if they have some sort of spiritual or religious connection, economic stability, and then just that feeling that I matter to someone. And so those are kind of some of the protective factors that we found.
Okay. And to learn more about this and all of this, one can attend the conference on 18th and 19th. And is the website junosuicideprevention.org?
That's correct. Another thing we didn't mention is that we have an opportunity for agencies and groups to exhibit their brochures or information. There are a lot of areas out there where people have resources, and this is a good place for them to present those resources for other folks to pick up. And if someone wants to be an exhibitor, they can go to junosuicideprevention.org and click on that homepage, and they can register. And that would register them for the conference. If, however, they want to exhibit and don't want to register for the conference, there is a link there to the person to contact to sign up and make arrangements to be an exhibitor.
Okay. Sounds good. Are we missing anything?
I think Julie has us covered, because I forgot both of those two things, but she remembered, so I think we're all right.
All right, Julie Neihart, Hillary Young, thank you both for coming in and sharing about this conference on the show today.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Thank you, and we hope people come.
Yeah.
All right.
This is Bird Note. In a garden near where the Mackenzie River rushes out of Oregon's Cascade Mountains, a downpour pummels crimson-flowered currants, salmon berries, red columbine, and native rhododendrons. Evening draws near, and I've taken shelter from the deluge. To my surprise, a female rufous hummingbird is still out and about, extracting nectar, searching for gnats and aphids. No doubt, she's feeding two nestlings that await her return to their tiny nest hidden in a Sitka spruce or Douglas fir. She'll feed them every half hour for 15 to 20 days. As night comes on, the feedings must increase. Rufous hummingbirds migrate mostly from Mexico, arriving in the Pacific Northwest and Alaska as early as March. By July, as higher elevations warm, they'll turn south again to follow a floral highway along the Rockies. This little bird will need to build her own energy reserves for this trip soon. I marvel at her stamina against the heavy rain. Think about it. Her body is 9.5 centimeters long. The average raindrop is about 4 millimeters. That would be like a person 5'8" being pounded by a torrent of raindrops, each 3 inches across. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
The Juneau Unitarian Universalist Fellowship is a welcoming congregation embracing many different beliefs and invites the community to join them on Sundays at 10 a.m. at the Temple Sukkot Shalom on Cordova Street in Douglas. More information is at juuf.org. This message brought to you by the Juneau Unitarian Universalist Fellowship.
You're listening to A Juneau Afternoon here on Tuesday, June 2nd, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. Joining me now in the studio from the Juneau Symphony is Dwayne Corbin. Welcome, Dwayne.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, and also Laura Haywood. Thanks for coming in,
Hi,
Laura.
Hi, Scott. Thanks.
So we have a few things to talk about today. We have the youth solo competition. We have the upcoming symphony on June 13th and 14th. Where should we start?
Let's start with the youth solo competition because it is tomorrow night. And this is when our really outstanding young musicians of Juneau, they've worked for a year memorizing a piece, and it's a competition, and the winners will get to play with either the Juneau Symphony or the Student Symphony. And so it's a huge investment of time and effort on their part, and they're just amazingly dedicated, talented people who are doing it.
Okay, and this is at Thunder Mountain tomorrow night?
This will be at Thunder Mountain High School, 7 p.m. tomorrow night.
Okay, and what's it look like? There's some accompaniment with a piano.
Yes. So basically the pianist is standing in for the orchestra. What they're pretending is that they are being accompanied by the full orchestra. So they're playing an orchestral reduction.
Mm-hmm.
And even the pianists, we have two pianists competing, and even they will have a piano accompanist.
who will be pretending
to be the orchestra. And Dwayne is going to be one of our judges. So he's not only our conductor, he's also a musician himself, and he has judged many of these kinds of contests. He hasn't done it in Juneau before, but has a lot of experience with that.
Okay, it looks like there's a junior division and a senior division. What are some of the instruments the kids will be playing, or the young adults will be playing?
Yeah, it's violin and piano. Is that it this year? Or do we have any other instruments?
That's what we have. And they range in age from 9 to 17.
And it's just amazing to watch. When I've done other competitions like this, and actually on this upcoming concert with the symphony next week, we have last year's winners playing with us. And that is going to be just an amazing experience. But these students put so much work, like Laura said, they put so much work into it, and it becomes just a really rewarding time for them to be able to work in a professional atmosphere with the symphony and to get on stage. I mean, think about it. These students, this is going to be the first time they've done a concerto in front of a large audience, most likely, unless they've done one in their school group beforehand. But certainly this high profile, this is the first time, and that we hope will start a long career in music, and really can be kind of an event that pushes them into their further study in music, which is really exciting. So I just love doing these kinds of events because of how much impact it has on the students' lives and their development musically.
Yeah, it sounds like a great opportunity. If any of the competitors are listening right now, what advice, what do you look for?
Uh-oh, I have to show my hand. You know, it's interesting. The comment you guys made about the accompaniment is really important because there's a different skill for a musician who plays with somebody versus playing by themselves, right? And so one of the things we look for in these soloists is not just that they have great technique and great musical skill, but that they're actually working with the accompanist. You know, do they look at them? I mean, as basic as that, right? Or does it look like they're just playing with a CD or something, right? You know, do they acknowledge the accompanist? Do they, you know, do you see the soloist lift the bow or lift the hand in a way that kind of shows the tempo of the next section? So there's this kind of human nature to it. Because as a conductor, that's going to be my cue is when they lift their hand and they, you know. So there's some body language elements, and that's reflective really of some musical maturity and reflective of how much they're really feeling it deep down, so that we can read the body language between the accompanist and the performer. But mostly we're looking for, are they playing with great musicality? Are they comfortable on stage? Are they confident? Do they know the music well? Are they playing it in a convincing manner? You know, certainly the ability to communicate with a soloist or the accompanist is important, but that's not the number one thing we're looking for, certainly.
Okay. Good answer. Laura, do you want to tell us some of the names of the folks that will be competing?
Yeah, I'd love to read their names. So we do, I kind of missed this before, we do have one flute player, and her name is Reese Bleakley. And we also have Henry Cheng, Elizabeth Jajali, Kyle Farley Robinson, Trevor Fiscus, Olivia Gardner, Emma Jessen, and Jordan McLucky.
Okay. I imagine that these students, these musicians, are probably a little bit nervous. Duane, you grew up as a musician as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
What might be some of your advice to them about their nerves right now?
Well, you know, nerves are a tricky thing. I think when I talk to most performers, because this question gets asked a lot of performers, and I think we just need to accept that you're going to be nervous, and that's okay. So to get up there and say, I'm nervous, and then you're like, oh, shoot, I shouldn't be nervous, and now I'm mad at myself because I'm nervous. You know what? We're all going to get nervous, and that happens to all of us as musicians. And the best performers, it's they can acknowledge that and then take a breath, and it goes away because they just accept it and like, yeah, you're right. You know what? I'm in front of a lot of people, and that's okay. That's the fun part of being a musician is getting to share. So we don't need to make it a fearful thing, but that's kind of our learned reaction to nervousness is we think it's bad. So you just have to kind of play through it and acknowledge that it's going to happen. And then most of anything that's bad in terms of nervousness is an issue of feeling unprepared. So these students, like Laura said, have been working for a year, so they're going to be prepared. And you know what? Just get up there and have fun. Be confident. You know, you've done the year's work on this thing, on this piece of music, and just show it off. And don't have any fear. Don't have any shame there. Just go play. Have fun.
And why don't you go ahead and plug? You're right that those two winners from last year are playing in your concert on the 13th and 14th.
Yeah. So we have
James Cheng,
who is going to be playing a Haydn cello concerto, and he played it for me when I was up last time rehearsing the orchestra in January, and it was fabulous. It's going to be really, really tremendous. And then Teza Haddock, is that
mm-hmm.
the last name? Yeah, will be playing Vivaldi concerto, and he is very young. What grade is he in?
I'm not sure.
I'm sorry, I didn't bring all my notes. I forgot we were going to talk about this part.
He actually competed in our junior division last year, and usually that means that the winner will play with our student symphony, but he was so outstanding that the judges said, you know what, we want him to play with the big symphony.
Right. Yeah, and when he played for me also in January, I was so impressed with his maturity and the professional sound he was getting. Sometimes younger soloists, it's a much smaller sound. It was a wonderful sound, very musical, great stage presence. And so we actually start rehearsals tonight, and so we'll work with those soloists, not tonight, but we'll get them in the orchestra early next week. And so I'm just really looking forward to that, and we want to make sure that people can come see. And it's interesting, in the period of a week and a half, you know, you guys can see both the competition and then the fruit of that competition from last year, all within 11 days.
Very exciting. Laura, will you give us the details of the competition again tomorrow night?
Okay, so it's tomorrow evening, Thunder Mountain High School Auditorium, 7 p.m. It's free, and there will be a reception afterwards. What they usually do is after the performances are over, the judges will confer and actually tell us the winner that night. So there's a little reception, cookies and punch and all that, and then we'll have the winner.
Great.
Okay, and very quickly, I'm sure we'll have you back on the show to talk about the big symphony, as you call it, Laura. I like it.
Mm-hmm.
But, Duane, can you tell us a little bit about what to expect on the 13th and 14th?
Yeah, it's our annual Pops concert, although it's a little different that we have the student soloists on this one, and that was because, as you know, they've been in the search this year, so they wanted to have the student conductor or the student performers on this concert with me as guest conductor instead of with the candidate conductors. And so we will do some film music, so from Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, and that is going to be wonderful. We'll do Sorcerer's Apprentice, of course famous from Fantasia. We'll have these solos, and then our concertmaster Lisa is going to be playing the theme from Schindler's List, a little four-minute version of that, which is just gorgeous, gorgeous piece. And then we'll end the concert with William Grant Still, his Symphony Number 1, which is a jazz and blues-inspired symphony. So it'll be a wonderful pop show with a huge amount of variety in it.
Indeed. Well, Duane Corbin and Laura Haywood, thank you both for coming on the show today. Are we missing anything? Anything you want to add?
good.
That's good. Thanks so much for your time.
All right. Thanks. We'll see you tomorrow night.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, June 2nd, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 12 minutes to the top of the hour. I've been joined in the studio now by KTOO's Justin Choman. Welcome to the show, Justin.
Thank you, Scott.
And sales Tristan Knutson-Lombardo. Welcome to the show, Tristan.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, so we are here to talk about the Only Fools Run at Midnight. What an event.
Yeah.
Tristan, you were just telling me 31 years in Juno?
That's right, yeah. It's one of the longest running, no pun intended, events in Juno. Initially, the Volunteer Firefighting Department put it on for MDA, Muscular
MDA.
Dystrophy Association. Yeah, and then about 16 years ago, they decided to change the format and move it to a Sunday, and it kind of fizzled, and then Sail 13 years ago brought it back, and now it's a big, wild, fun event that we've put on for the last, this is our 13th year. But this year, we're passing it off to K2 and public media.
Justin, how many years do you think we'll take it on?
From now until forever.
Right.
We've got some big shoes to fill, though, honestly. It's been great working with Tristan and learning a lot about the history of this event and kind of just now coming to understand that you really brought it back and made it the institution that it seems to be here on a Saturday night. And we're excited. We're really excited and really honored to take this over from Sale and to work with them hand-in-hand this year. And all proceeds from the event this year will actually be split between both organizations. So it's really a great opportunity to come out and support the work and the mission of Sale, as well as KTOO here in Juneau.
Absolutely. Tristan, for folks that haven't seen the event before, please describe it for us.
Well, it's quite the experience. You know, I remember when I started running the event, I was just a little kid, and it was a big deal to stay up till midnight. You know, I mean, it was one of the few things my parents let me do, and you could dress up in a wild costume, and you were running in the streets in downtown Juneau. But it is, we get, you know, last year we had over 700 people that registered. We always have a few that kind of hop in and just join the fun. We have a lot of people out in the streets at midnight running through Juneau, and we have a lot of costumes. It's really, we haven't timed the event in quite a while, but most people are there just because they want to have fun, support the organization. So we get people with a lot of creative costumes. They dress up in centipedes, five or more people connected together in some form or fashion. You know, we've had, one year we had the 50 states and some territories. We had a deck of cards. We've had, one year, a group from Perseverance Theater, there was this really beautiful papier-mâché dragon that three or four of them ran the whole 5K course in. We've had actual centipedes or millipedes out there. People get pretty creative with the costumes.
Definitely sounds like a lot of fun. There are like some different distances though, and there are some folks that come out and are serious, right, and can actually race.
There's always somebody that's looking to get a good time, no matter the time of day. They want to try to, you know, knock off their 5K PR. We have a 5K and a 1 mile, so, and people are encouraged to do whatever they would like to do. We get a lot of little kids out, and a lot of little kids that like to do the full 5K. They've been drinking soda all night, so they're pumped up and ready to go. But really, it's a great event for all ages, all abilities, if you're looking to race hard or if you just want to go have fun. A couple years ago, there was a really great little article in the Juneau Empire, I think it was, but there was a woman, and I can't remember her name, but she had benefited from Sale services and was out there with her daughter and on with her walker and walked the 1 mile course, and it was pretty cool actually and pretty inspirational to see. So that it was an opportunity for her to get out and show support for the agency and have fun with everybody else.
Absolutely. If somebody wants to get involved, what is that process like?
Well, if you want to volunteer, actually Justin is the volunteer coordinator this year. So you can give him a call or shoot him an email.
Yeah, and that's my number is 463-6422. And my email is Justin with an S, so JUSTINS at KTOO.org.
And we're looking for people to help volunteer on the course, directing people and watching out for cars and bears and that sort of thing, helping register people at the beginning. You know, we have hundreds of people that come in needing to register. We give all our volunteers T-shirts, so it's a nice souvenir for their time. People can help us set up. The day before, we're rolling T-shirts and matching registration forms to bibs. People can always help out with that. So if they don't want to stay up till midnight, they can come do that. There's a lot of opportunities for help and support. But if you actually want to be out there racing, we have a slew of registration locations this year. You can find registration on the web, both at K2's website and also Sale's website. You can or stop by either of the offices, the station here or Sale office, to register. You can register at either First Bank location, either JRC, the Alaska Club, Nugget Alaskan Outfitter, or Pavitt Health and Fitness.
Okay. Well, this is going to be a fun one. Justin, it'll be your first. How are you going to participate?
I will be coordinating volunteers. So look for me with a Fool's Run T-shirt at the volunteer table.
No costume.
Well, maybe.
Oh, he'll have a costume.
That's right. That's right. See, this is all new to me. So this is my first summer in Juneau. So this will, without a guy, I suppose it goes without saying, my first only Fool's Run at midnight here in Juneau. I'm excited and involved in a manner which I didn't necessarily expect, but it's great. I mean, like I said before, this is a really fantastic opportunity, and we're excited to partner with Sale this year.
All right. Well, it sounds like fun, you guys. Justin Schoeman, Tristan Knutson-Lombardo, thanks for coming in. What are we missing? Anything?
June 13th. is we, I don't think we ever said that.
When it actually is? That would be helpful, yeah. Right?
June 13th, 11:59 p.m., that's when the gun goes off. Don't be late. Registration closes at 5 p.m. on June 11th, the pre-registration. So if you want to get a slight discount on registration and a really good chance of getting a T-shirt, do that. Otherwise, doors open 10:30 p.m., June 13th, Centennial Hall. We'll see you there.
And again, you can get connected to all of this information by just going to ktoo.org
and
click on the button that says Only Fools Run at Midnight.
Totally.
You guys, thank you so much. Have a good one.
Thanks.
Thank you, Scott.
Everybody's got you pegged right. Is that why you got in touch with me? I guess you must be running out of food. You left me all alone with that fire. Your goodbye was even colder. Didn't bother you, I was crying. Now you wanna break my heart twice. Is that why you got in touch with me? I guess you must be running out of food. You got back to my name in your little black book. Tell you what, I guess you forgot how I even look. Yes, you did. Go ahead with all your sweet talking. Go ahead for all the good it can do. Have yourself a dime with the talking. Then I'm gonna hang right up on you.
Support comes from Southeast Living Magazine, Southeast Alaska's home, real estate, and lifestyle magazine, working to reach potential home buyers and featuring articles and tips on home improvement, available at various locations in Southeast.
Join us for the next live television recording of Writer's Showcase. The theme is open and includes works by John Urban, Taylor Ciambra, Rachel Riley, and Justin Herman. The stories take us from the top of Eagle Crest to the streets of Anchorage and explore everything from love to addiction to disappointment with both humor and poignancy. Readers are Boston Christopher, Alicia Hugh Scandies, Denise Scott, and Brandon Demery. Admission is free this coming Wednesday at 360 at 7 p.m. sharp. Info at 360north.org.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon today. Tomorrow, Lori Scandling will be your host. She'll talk with Robin Thomas about hospice and home care of Juno and their fundraising whale watch on Saturday. We'll get a preview of Thursday's VA Town Hall listening session with guest Linda Yeager. We'll highlight the Shepherd of the Valleys bike rodeo, and Madge Pratt will be here to tell us about her First Friday art show at the Silver Bow. Let's take a look at the weather here. Looks like rain, highs around 57 tomorrow. Thursday rain, highs around 57. Friday rain, highs around 58, and rain likely into the weekend.